From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story of the Sarajevo newspaper that has published every day in spite of shelling, hunger, despair, and death. We'll talk with Tom Jelton, who's covered the war in Bosnia for NPR. His new book, Sarajevo Daily, tells the story of the newspaper and its staff, which has exemplified the spirit of pluralism, perseverance, and courage in a city under siege. We'll also hear about some of Jelton's own experiences covering the war for NPR. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Former Vice President Dan Quayle has dropped out of the presidential race. His Republican rivals are surveying the new field. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole says Quayle would have been a formidable rival for the Republican nomination. Texas Senator Phil Graham says with Quayle's departure, he is now the real conservative left in the race. President Clinton says he's a little surprised at the former vice president's decision. An advisor says Quayle will announce later today he's leaving the race because of fundraising difficulties. Former Senator J. William Fulbright has died. He suffered a stroke earlier today. Fulbright served in the Senate for 30 years. He took on presidents and his colleagues and was known for his strong opposition to the Vietnam War. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Former Senator William Fulbright, a Democrat from Arkansas, served in Congress for 32 years, 30 in the Senate and 2 in the House. His widow, Harriet, says he died in his sleep at home this morning after suffering a stroke. Fulbright is known for irritating both President Johnson and President Truman, but was a hero to activists for his criticism of the arrogance of power in the Vietnam War. Senators spoke eloquently today in remembrance of Fulbright, who was described as a singular force in American politics. Arkansas Senator David Pryor.
I rise to pay tribute today to a former member of this body who has repeatedly made history in his lifetime and who dared to articulate a vision throughout his lifetime. That man is J. William Fulbright.
Fulbright served as chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin has fired two top army generals in what may be the first in a series of reprisals for the poorly planned Chechen invasion. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
The main target of public criticism has been the defense minister, Pavel Grachov. He still remains in his job, but President Yeltsin removed two of his deputies, Matvey Burlakov, already suspended and under investigation for a corruption scandal, is a close Grachov ally. The other, Georgi Kondratiev, has recently become one of Grachov's harshest critics, calling the Chechen invasion ill-planned. In sacking two such different people, Yeltsin's actions so far are hard to read. But according to the newspaper Izvestia, public opinion is convinced Grachov will soon go too. In a clear attempt to save his skin, Grachov lashed out at critics today. He said attacks on him were veiled attempts to remove President Yeltsin. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
A real estate trade group says the increase in home prices has slowed down. The National Association of Realtors surveyed 133 metro areas in the fourth quarter of last year. It reports prices rose in 80 of those areas. Most of the increases were 6% or less. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down a point at 39.34. This is NPR. Somali gunmen killed an Italian TV cameraman in Mogadishu one day after U.S. and Italian troops landed in Somalia to oversee the evacuation of remaining peacekeepers from Operation Restore Hope. NPR Silvia Poggioli reports from Rome.
Cameraman Marcello Palmisano and reporter Carmen Lasorella were near the airport today when their car was attacked by six armed Somalis known as technicals. The ambush followed a demonstration by thousands of hostile Somalis against a U.S.-led task force protecting the pullout of the last U.N. troops. Italy's RAI-TV reported that Palmisano, a 55-year-old journalist who had covered Vietnam, Lebanon, and Yugoslavia, was killed in the attack. Reporter La Sorella was then taken to her house by gunmen, where she was beaten and robbed and later released. Palmisano was the third Italian journalist to be killed in Somalia in less than a year. Last March, a TV reporter and her cameraman were shot at close range. The journalists had been investigating reports of Italian arms traffic to Somalia. This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
Federal prosecutors say they've charged six people with a $2 million insider trading scheme. The prosecutors say the trading involves securities of firms targeted for takeover by AT&T. The indictment alleges the defendants got inside information about the takeovers from two AT&T employees. The Justice Department is looking at whether an independent counsel should investigate Commerce Secretary Ron Brown. Assistant Attorney General Sheila Anthony says the Justice Department is considering the matter. She's forwarded a letter to North Carolina Senator Locke Faircloth. She says the department will check if Brown's case meets the standards set under the independent counsel law. Senator Faircloth is one of a group of Republicans questioning Brown's business dealings in a communications company. They want to know why he got more than $400,000 from the firm, though he invested no money in it. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When the siege of Sarajevo began, the editor of the daily newspaper pledged to publish the paper every day as long as the city survived. The multi-ethnic staff risked their lives to get out the paper. Several died. My guest Tom Jelton has used the story of the newspaper as a focus to tell the larger story of the siege of Sarajevo. His new book is called Sarajevo Daily. Jelton has covered the war in the former Yugoslavia for National Public Radio. His reporting was honored with a George Polk Award and the Overseas Press Club's Lowell Thomas Award. The Sarajevo newspaper is called Oslobođenje, which means liberation. Its headquarters were torn apart by daily shelling over a five-month period in 1992. When the building finally collapsed, the staff moved underground into the building's bomb shelter. I asked Tom Jelton to describe the newspaper.
Sarajevo's daily newspaper, Oslobođenje, was, before the war, I should say, it was very much like papers we see, a full broadsheet format with three colors. It had a sports section, a weather section. I mean, it was very much like American newspapers. After the war began, with the shortage of newsprint, it began shrinking, first down to a tabloid size, and then the number of pages began shrinking, went to just black ink, so that at its smallest, it was eight tabloid pages. They had, of course, far fewer staff and no access, essentially, to news from the outside world. There was no sports section. Two pages a day, or sometimes three pages a day at the height of the war, were taken up by obituaries, death notices. And sadly, this was among the most widely read portions of the paper. A lot of people were dying in Sarajevo, and the communication within Sarajevo was so cut off. I mean, telephone lines weren't operating. People were not free to walk up and down streets, bump into their neighbors. So the kind of the natural network of rumors and gossip was just cut off. People didn't know what happened to a good friend of yours you might not see for weeks at a time. And of course, the one thing that you worry about is that he or she has been killed. So people every morning would scour over those death notices. The first thing, just the same way that people would read, say, like a casualty list after an accident, a plane accident or something like that, to see if anyone you know was killed. So that was probably the most important part of the newspaper. And then there was the standard news about what happened in the government that day. There would always be a kind of a scattering of news from the United Nations or Washington or wherever Bosnia, the war, was being discussed. The Oslobođenje editors wanted to apprise the people of Sarajevo to what was going on in the world around them as it concerned Bosnia.
You mentioned the importance of the obituaries. You reprint a few of them in your book Sarajevo Daily. Let me ask you to read one of them just to give us a sense of what the obituaries were like. Who actually wrote them?
The people whose family members were lost wrote them. I mean, I was at the newspaper office. I used to hang out at the newspaper office, Sarajevo Daily office, every day when I was working on researching this book. And there would be a steady stream of people coming into the newspaper offices with little scraps of paper upon which they'd scrawled these little death notices of husbands, sons, fathers, wives, children, anyone who had been killed. And the newspaper would not edit them. Newspaper would just print exactly what the people wrote. They had a policy that they would print one notice for anyone who'd been killed free of charge. Now, sometimes friends and family members, you would maybe get somebody else would want to print a separate death notice, you know, in their own words. And if you second or third notices of someone's death, they would charge a few pennies for. But the first one was free.
So why don't you read one of the obituaries that you've reprinted?
Okay, Terry, this is an obituary for Farid Pilav. In painful memory of our beloved brother Farid, son of Meho Pilav, dear brother, words cannot express the sadness and the pain that your parting has left in my heart, but as long as I live, your memory will be with me. Forgive me for not having been able to organize your burial as I would have liked, but you were so magnificent that any burial would have been too modest for you. With love, your sister Farida.
Did these obituaries sometimes take the place of the funerals that couldn't be held because of shelling?
They would. Whenever someone was killed, there would always be a few close friends, family members, who would show up at the cemetery for the burial. It was, in some cases, very dangerous. The Lion Cemetery, which is where Farid Pilav was buried, was very close to the front line, and it was exposed to sniper fire. And it was very sad to see these burials, because they would show up and very quickly carry the coffin over to the gravesite, put it in the ground as quickly as they could, say a few prayers over the grave, and then run away. And there would actually be times, Terry, when they would have to take cover during the burial itself, because they would come under shooting.
Tom Jelton is my guest. He's reported on the war in Bosnia for National Public Radio, and now he has a new book about the daily paper that has kept publishing through the war, and the book is called Sarajevo Daily. Tom, because it was so dangerous for the reporters to go out on assignment, it was really a nightmare for the editors to make assignments determining where the reporters would go and who would be at most risk. Something really traumatic happened to Gordana Knezevich, one of the editors who you write about. Would you tell us that story about the most traumatic assignment she made?
Yes, Terry. The editor-in-chief, Kemal Kurspahic, was laid up as a result of a car accident he suffered in Sarajevo during wartime. So the day-to-day management of the paper was turned over to Gordana Knezevich, who was the first person, actually, that I met in Sarajevo, and she was deputy editor of Oslobođenje at the time. It was through her and her family, really, that I came to know the people of Oslobođenje.
In fact, let me just stop you here and say, your listeners will remember the Knezevich family from, you know, some of the reports that you did on NPR, in which you were in their apartment listening to shelling in the neighborhood as they described to you how their lives had changed because of the war.
Right. When I first showed up in Sarajevo, I didn't have anywhere to stay, and I ended up sort of crashing at the Knezevich house and sleeping on their couch. And after about a week, I did this long interview with them about what it was like in Sarajevo. That was way back in June of 1992. About a month after that, Kemal, the editor, was in this car accident, and Gordana took over running the newspaper. Now, it's important to understand that Gordana is a Serb, or as she would say, she was born a Serb. She doesn't think of herself, her identity, the fact her Serbian ancestry is not so crucial to her identity, but she is of Serbian background, and which was very difficult for her being in Sarajevo, a city that's encircled and under attack by Serb nationalist forces. Obviously, it's something that makes her feel a bit uncomfortable. She took over running the newspaper. She had to every day send reporters and photographers out on their assignments. She had one older gentleman. His name was Salko Hondo. He was a photographer, 55 years old, and he was one of the Sarajevans who was, frankly, afraid of getting hurt, afraid of going outside. He went to Gordon and said, please don't send me on any assignment that is risky. I just don't want to die. I don't want to get hurt. And she said, okay, Salko, I'm going to just use you to photograph like ceremonial occasions. I'll use you when visitors come to the Bosnian Presidency building, things like that, where you don't have to worry. But one day, she got a story that somebody was building a well in their front yard, and she knew that this was right by Salko's house. And she said, one of these days on your way to or from work, if you could just stop and take a picture of these people digging a well, it would be a nice picture. He did it that very same day on his way to work after lunch break. And while he was taking the picture of these people digging a well, a mortar shell landed and he was killed. And because he had told Gordon that this was precisely what he's afraid of, and she had given him that assignment, it just destroyed her. For days afterward, she just stayed home. She couldn't talk to anyone. She couldn't make any assignments. She tried to resign her leadership position. She said, I just can't take this responsibility of telling people where to go, knowing that it could mean they would be killed.
So when she went back to work, how did she deal with assignments?
Well, she got over it. You know, things, terrible tragedies happened like this all the time, and newspaper had to be put out. She was needed at the newspaper. Her staff helped her get over it, said, you know, there's nothing that you could do about this. We need you here. We need you making assignments. You're a fair person. And she got over it, just as people in Sarajevo got over terrible, terrible tragedies every day.
My guest is Tom Jelton. He's covered the war in the Balkans for NPR. His new book is called Sarajevo Daily, A City and Its Newspaper Under Siege. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with NPR's Tom Jelton. He's written a new book called Sarajevo Daily, A City and Its Newspaper Under Siege. There were a lot of debates within the editorial leadership of the paper about how objective to be, when it was appropriate to consider being partisan, should they criticize the Bosnian government or stand behind the government. Could you give us a sense of some of the most crucial debates?
The key debate was what relationship the newspaper should have towards the Bosnian government. And the reason this is so important is because the paper had fought very hard over the previous 2 years to gain political independence. First, it, through a great deal of effort, threw off the Communist Party, which was essentially running the newspaper, appointing the editors, telling them what stories to run, and so forth. They threw off Communist Party control. Free elections were held in Bosnia. A new government came in. The new government was dominated by nationalists on all sides, Muslim nationalists, Serb nationalists, and Croat nationalists. They got together and wanted to run to basically apportion the jobs at the newspaper along ethnic lines, leaving, say, targeting the photo editor position as a Muslim position, the sports editor as a Serb position, so forth. The staff rose up, united, and went to court to throw off that type of political control. So they had worked very hard to establish themselves as politically independent. Along comes the war, and the staff are all patriots. They all believe in the goal of a united Bosnia. They are uniformly against the Serb nationalist forces that are attacking Sarajevo, and they want patriotically to support the Bosnian cause. At the same time, they want to maintain political independence. Well, in wartime, that's a very difficult balance to achieve, and different people at the newspaper saw it differently. Some felt that it was important over and over to demonstrate that they could oppose their government just as they could oppose their previous government in peacetime. Others felt that that was a luxury that could actually undermine the Bosnian cause and that they should be careful about opposing it. This was a debate that continued throughout wartime. These days, it's important to point out that the newspaper has more or less established itself as an opposition voice in Sarajevo. But it has taken them a long time to figure out the kind of role that would be appropriate for them to play in wartime.
What were some of the consequences the editors felt they would face if they criticized the government?
Well, Sarajevo was under siege, which means that everything from diesel oil to newsprint, telephone lines, all these kinds of things were basically in government hands. If the government wanted to shut down Sarajevo Daily, Oslobodzhenje, they could do it at a moment's notice. And it was very important to the paper to continue publishing. So they had to worry that the government was going to shut them down. Secondly, there was some crime and lawlessness in Sarajevo during wartime. Some of the most fierce fighters who defended Sarajevo actually came from pretty shady backgrounds and didn't necessarily believe in things like free press and democracy and so forth, and were more than willing to trash anyone or any organization that they felt wasn't part of the Bosnian cause. I tell the story in the book of a radio station that played Serbian folk songs in response to listener requests. And this group of soldiers came in and literally blew up the radio station. They threw a hand grenade into the control room, roughed up the DJs and the station manager. So this was what Oslobodzhenje had to consider. This is what the editors of the newspaper in Sarajevo had to consider might happen to them if they crossed the government. So, you know, it's easy for us in the United States and in Western countries to say, well, you know, these newspapers should be more independent of the government. But it's important in saying that to realize what price independence can carry in a wartime situation.
What about the meaning of fairness and objectivity during wartime in Sarajevo? What were some of the different interpretations of that within the staff?
First of all, one of the problems with objectivity, let's say, in reporting in Sarajevo, was that sources of information, first-hand sources of information, were rare. A lot of the time, they had to rely on the Bosnian army's own. The Bosnian army had a little press center that turned out reports of what was happening on the battlefield around the country. The editors and reporters could not verify that, so they had to basically take the Bosnian army's word for it a lot of the time. Those of us who knew better knew that a lot of those reports were slanted, that they exaggerated Bosnian army victories and ignored their defeats and so forth. So in that sense, the newspaper was not always objective about what it reported. When they did, to their credit, when they did come across information that did not jive with what the government was telling them, they usually reported it. For example, one of the sources of information that was independent was the daily press briefings at the United Nations headquarters. Often, the UN briefers would give a completely different account of some war development than the Bosnian army was giving. And Oslobodzhenje reporters, to their credit, would report exactly what the UN said. And that account would appear in the newspaper. Maybe it would be on page 4, and the Bosnian army's version would be on page 1. But the reports were in there. They weren't censored out. And there were also some cases where Oslobodzhenje reporters themselves, acting independently, came upon stories that no one else had, that did not put the Bosnian government and the Bosnian army in a good light necessarily, and they did not hesitate to publish them. One story that impressed me the most was of an Oslobodzhenje correspondent in Fojnice, which is a town in central Bosnia, who found out that two Franciscan Catholic priests in his town had been murdered by Bosnian army soldiers. He had been good friends with those priests. He was himself a Muslim, but he regarded those priests as true friends. And he wrote a long first-person story about exactly what happened to them and who did it. And Oslobodzhenje published it. So those are all the examples that show that they were, under circumstances, objective. Now, they also inevitably referred to the Serb side as the aggressor. Some editors, desk editors, would slip in words referring to the Croat militiamen in central Bosnia as Ustasha, Ustasha being a pejorative term referring to the Croat fascists of the Second World War. So there were almost everyday instances as well that in which the newspaper did not display fairness and objectivity. But overall, you know, I was fairly impressed by it.
Oslobođenje, the newspaper that you write about, is a multi-ethnic paper. There were people representing all the ethnicities at the paper. Were there ethnic troubles behind the scenes at the paper?
That is one of the most remarkable things about this story. There were terrible struggles at the paper. There were terrible factional fights. People hated each other. They would say the worst things about each other behind the back. There were often opposing camps. But strangely, these lines never coincided with ethnic lines. It wasn't the Muslim faction versus the Serb faction. It was about such issues as what relationship they should have to the government, and who was getting to represent and speak for the newspaper on trips abroad. There were all kinds of things that people fought over, and yet there was virtually no evidence that I can think of, and I know these people very well, of ethnic tensions where Muslims at the paper sort of ganged up on Serbs, or Serbs kept together sort of to defend themselves. People just didn't mix that way. A lot of the people, first of all, you have to understand that in Sarajevo, a third of the marriages in Sarajevo the year before the war began were of people from different national, religious, ethnic backgrounds. And the proportion at Oslobođenje was, in fact, much higher than that. I think that every Serb who I got to know at Oslobođenje was married to a non-Serb. So with ethnic lines crossing, you know, running through the middle of families, there was just sort of no natural breakdown along ethnic lines. It was very impressive to me.
You know, a couple of times we've had the opportunity to have on people from Sarajevo who managed to get out through the UN and come to the States either to accept an award or to make a speech or whatever, and then they were going back. And I always wondered a couple of things. One was there a lot of resentment on the part of the people who weren't able to get out? And also what it was like for them to return. What was it like after staying at the Hilton to go back to Bosnia? And you write about that a little bit, and it sounds like there was resentment on the people who stayed and watched people come and go, and that it was terrible to return, that it was really hard to return.
Yeah, I think it's perfectly understandable. I mean, people are human, and the living conditions in Sarajevo are just terrible. I mean, in wintertime, for example, it gets dark at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. A lot of people can't afford candles. They sit around in the darkness for hours. It's often cold. They don't have money to buy firewood, which is exorbitantly expensive. They don't have decent food. They can't watch television. I mean, for much of this time, they've had to worry about being killed every time they step outdoors. And the idea that some people are able to get on a UN flight and fly away to Sarajevo and maybe, in the case of Oslobođenje editors, receive awards, you know, in New York or London or Berlin or whatever, and maybe get a fellowship and spend some time at a university somewhere in Europe or the United States, those people who stay back in Sarajevo are naturally terribly resentful of it. And the people who leave often are so overwhelmed by guilt while they're gone that they can't really enjoy or experience what they're going through. I tell a story in the book of Gordana one time going to New York to accept an award for Oslobođenje. She was a very articulate speaker and represented the newspaper in Sarajevo very well, so she was called upon on more than one occasion to accept awards on behalf of the newspaper and to talk about Sarajevo. And she was so overwhelmed by guilt at where she was, and also so afraid to relax and experience the comfort that surrounded her, that she would literally carry plastic-wrapped sandwiches around in her handbag and eat those instead of going to a restaurant or a banquet or something like that, because she was afraid that she would lose that balance that she needed in order to be able to come and go from Sarajevo.
We'll be back with NPR's Tom Gjelten in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Living Language. Learn a new language at home or on the go with Living Language. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, covering Sarajevo under siege, we continue our conversation with NPR's Tom Jelton. His new book is about the city's daily newspaper, which has made good on its pledge to publish every day in spite of the siege. We'll find out how Jelton managed to report on the Serbs who were firing on the newspaper's headquarters. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has again defended his nominee for the Surgeon General's post. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
In a joint news conference with the German Chancellor, Mr. Clinton mounted a strong defense of Surgeon General nominee Dr. Henry Foster, the president blasting Foster's critics.
I know that those who believe that we should abolish the right to choose and make conduct which is now legal criminal will try to seize upon this nomination to negate the work of a man's life and define him in cardboard cutout terms, but I think that is wrong.
Mr. Clinton says he thinks the American people will favor Foster's nomination when they hear him in his Senate confirmation hearing. Bill Small at the White House.
The House is debating parts of the Republican crime package intended to fund more prisons. The measure calls for $10.5 billion in new prison construction over 5 years. The money would go only to states that meet certain criteria of tough sentences for violent criminals. Attorney General Janet Reno says only three states would then qualify: Arizona, Delaware, and North Carolina. The walk in space for two of Discovery's astronauts came to an early end today. Problems with a newly designed spacesuit forced the astronauts to return to the shuttle. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Crew members Michael Fole and Bernard Harris were testing NASA's new spacesuit, which was designed to keep them warmer while working in the deep chill of space. Part of the suit's design was a new and improved glove for the astronauts' hands. The new glove was designed to keep the hands warmer while providing greater flexibility. About 3.5 hours into the planned 5-hour walk, both Fole and Harris began complaining that their hands were getting very cold, especially when they would grab hold of the Spartan science satellite in the cargo bay. At that point, mission managers decided enough data had been collected and that the two should return to the inside of the shuttle. The information will be used to improve on the glove that will be a crucial piece of equipment when astronauts spend hours in orbit building an international space station. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The accused ringleader of the World Trade Center bombing has pleaded not guilty in federal court. Ramzi Youssef was apprehended in Pakistan on Tuesday and taken immediately to New York. Authorities say Youssef bought and mixed the chemicals for the bombs that killed 6 people and injured more than 1,000 in the Trade Center bombing nearly 2 years ago. Former Arkansas Senator J. William Fulbright has died at his Washington home. He was 89. His widow says he died of a stroke early today. Fulbright served in both the House and Senate and often tangled with presidents and his colleagues. He sponsored the international program to exchange students and scholars that continues under his name. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow fell 2.5 points to end at 3,932. Advancing issues led declines by a small margin. This is NPR. President Clinton says NATO is eventually going to expand to the east in Europe. He says this might upset Russia, but the alliance plans to have closer ties to the former Soviet republic. The NATO discussion has come up as German Chancellor Helmut Kohl visits the White House. Kohl says Germany agrees with the United States, since European stability is more important than ever. Both leaders say the spreading of NATO must be gradual, and relations with Russia as well as Ukraine must be built up. Voters in India went to the polls today in the first phase of crucial state elections. The results could prompt an early general election. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
Nearly 50 million people are expected to vote in the western Indian state of Maharashtra. It's India's richest state, and the capital, Bombay, is the country's commercial hub. Prime Minister Narasimha Rao's Congress Party has held power in the state for the past 47 years, but opinion polls suggest that the party could lose this election, and that could force Prime Minister Rao to resign before his term expires next year. 2 months ago, the Congress Party lost power in two key states, including the Prime Minister's home state. Analysts attribute the voter backlash to high inflation and charges of government corruption. This is Eric Weiner in New Delhi.
PLO leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin have concluded their meeting in Gaza today. Aides say the meeting was not productive. A Palestinian spokesman accuses Israel of procrastination. He says Rabin is using security as an excuse not to withdraw Israeli troops from the West Bank. The spokesman says that's also why Israel has delayed Palestinian elections. Rabin has rejected Arafat's demands to end the 19-day closure of the West Bank and Gaza. Government authorities in Colombia report 37 people have died from yesterday's powerful earthquake. The number is expected to rise as rescue efforts continue. Radio reports say teams are going through the rubble of buildings and they are still looking for survivors. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Back with me for the second part of our show is Tom Gelton, who has covered the war in the former Yugoslavia for National Public Radio. His new book, Sarajevo Daily, is about Sarajevo's daily newspaper, Oslobođenje, which has kept publishing through the siege. Gelton writes about the staff, which has carried on the spirit of pluralism during an ethnic war. And he chronicles the debates among the editors about journalistic principles like fairness and objectivity during wartime. Tom, did you have any journalistic principles that you felt were challenged or affirmed as you watched the editors and reporters of Oslobođenje put out the paper?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because there's been a lot of debate in this country about whether American and European reporters were personally so touched and moved by what they saw and experienced in Sarajevo that they lost their own ability to be objective. I mean, we were talking earlier about the difficulty that Oslobođenje reporters, that Sarajevo reporters had maintaining objectivity. And this naturally extended as well to foreign reporters who came and spent a long time in Sarajevo, who made friends there, who and they were themselves. We were ourselves in danger a lot of the time. A lot of the the bombardment of Sarajevo was barbaric at times, and so it is a challenge. There's no question about it. It is a challenge to report the story from Sarajevo and maintain objectivity about what is happening. Now, so this was a time for me to really think through what being objective and being truthful and being fair meant under circumstances like this.
Well, what did you come up with that was maybe different than what you'd thought before?
Well, I came to the conclusion that it was not necessary for me to completely smother my own feelings as a witness to what was going on, because a journalist has the responsibility of communicating to people what he or she sees and feels around, and the suffering was so great in Sarajevo that I thought that it was, as a journalist, it was perfectly natural for me to let some emotion seep through into my voice when I was making reports. But what I learned was how to draw a distinction, or what I should say, I tried to do is to distinguish between letting that passion come through and editorializing. This is the worst danger. This is the worst worst thing that a reporter in a situation like that can do, is to sort of lecture your readers or your listeners about what's going on and isn't this terrible and who's to blame and so forth. That is completely inappropriate. So I really had to work just on describing what I saw, what I felt, what was happening, but stop at the point of sort of offering my opinions about it or analysis of it or even your choice of words can connote sometimes a kind of an editorializing about what you're seeing. It's a difficult thing to do. I'm not always saying that I managed to do it, but it is something I thought about a lot.
My guest is NPR reporter Tom Gelton. He's written a new book about Sarajevo's daily newspaper called Sarajevo Daily, A City and Its Newspaper Under Siege. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Gelton. He's covered the war in the Balkans for NPR. There's a part in your book where you describe how you reported on the Serbs who were actually shooting at the Oslobojenja building. And you were you were reporting on the Serbs. You saw a gun trained on the building. You saw a hole in which they looked out of the building and could see the people who worked at the paper. I kept thinking, what a really strange experience that must have been for you. And here you are, like, reporting on it. You're not there to quarrel with them or to blame, to point your finger and say, how can you do this? These are my friends and colleagues you're firing on. What was it like to be there?
It was really bizarre because I had been only a few days before. I had been in the Oslobojenja building. The cook, Oslobojenja had its own cook, and his little kitchen was on that side of the building facing the Serb positions. And he used to take me around, and we'd peek out through a crack, and he'd say, "You see that house over there? That's where the gun is, and they shoot at us from over there." And then he'd point to his refrigerator, and the refrigerator would be full of bullet holes and so forth. And we'd always have to be very careful to whisper and, you know, make sure that there wasn't any light so we could be seen and so forth. And then to be a few days over, to be in that very house and have the Serb army soldier point across the way to Oslobojenja and say, you know, that's the building we shoot at, is, of course, a very strange feeling, particularly because I have to say that the Serbs on that side of the line treated me very graciously. They wanted me to have lunch with them. They brought out a bottle of plum brandy, and they had roast lamb, and they wanted me to hear their side of the story. You know, and as a journalist, I have to sit down and listen to them and be decent with them. And it is a kind of a schizophrenic experience because I know what it's like to be shot at. And, you know, people that I've spent a lot of time with are being shot at by these very guys that I'm seated around the table with. So it is hard.
Well, what kind of explanation did they offer you for why they're shooting at Oslobojenja?
Well, they said, and actually, I'm not going to question this because I don't know whether it's true or not, that the Oslobojenja building was inhabited from time to time by Bosnian army snipers. I mean, even the ruin itself was still tall. It was about the elevator shaft was all that was left standing of the old building. But it towered up there above the Serb front lines and was a great sniper's nest. I can't say that there weren't from time to time snipers in the Bosnian army in the Oslobojenja tower shooting at them. They always claimed that they were shooting back at people who were shooting at them. I knew there were no snipers in the newspaper area. People were just working there trying to put out their newspaper. But that was the real. I mean, they didn't claim that they were shooting at the newspaper because of the ideals that it stood for. It wasn't any kind of symbolic thing. They just claimed this was war, and they're on that side, and we're on this side, and we shoot back and forth all the time, and they happen to be in that building, and we shoot at them there, and they shoot back at us, and that's the way it is.
How'd you get in the position where you could talk to the Serbians who were manning the guns that were aimed at that building? Did you just knock on the door and say, I want to hear your side of the story?
Well, you know, that house was about 50 yards away from the Oslobođenje building. But in order to reach that house, I did not have my own armored car like a lot of reporters do. Reporters with armored cars could sort of drive at will around back and forth across the front lines, you know, and in the morning interview the Serb side and the afternoon interview the Bosnian side. That is a dangerous thing to do. And if you don't have an armored car, you can't do it. So in order to get to that house, I actually had to ride a UN shuttle to the airport, fly to Split, in Croatia, make my way around through Zagreb up to Budapest in Hungary, take the train down because there are no flights operating to Belgrade because Yugoslavia was subject to sanctions. So I take a train from Budapest to Belgrade, rent a car and an interpreter in Belgrade, and then drive across Serb-held territory in Bosnia until I got to the outskirts of Sarajevo and made my way up to that little house. So I'd be 50 yards away from where I'd been, and it could be, you know, it'd be a 2 or 3 day journey to get there.
That's unbelievable. I mean, I believe you. That's remarkable. When you were going through that journey, it must have felt like you were trapped in some absurdist drama.
Well, it only made it all the more, I mean, that gap between the Bosnian side and the Serb side was so real, and was so unbridgeable in that sense. And having to go through all that travel to get across that little stretch of land only served to make that division all the more real and sort of unfathomable.
But just explain to me again how it helped to take that convoluted route. Did you have Serbs traveling with you, knowing where you were going, knowing that you were a reporter?
Well, that's another part of why this journey had to be taken in such a convoluted way, because you really couldn't work on the Serb side with, let's say, a Muslim interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't work on the Bosnian side with an interpreter from the Serb side. And I didn't speak the language so that I couldn't operate on my own independently. So basically, the only way to approach the Serb side was in the company of a Serb interpreter and with all the proper permission slips that are issued only by the Serbian authorities. And the same thing on the Bosnian side. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't take an interpreter from Sarajevo over there. It would be useless to have a Serb interpreter from Pale, from the headquarters of the Serb Nationalists in Sarajevo. So, you know, all the baggage and all the logistics that go along with reporting in a war zone are themselves separated into two very different worlds.
So did you end up eating lamb with the Serbs who you were reporting on?
I did. They had, you know, on the Serb side of Sarajevo, there's no siege. They're not encircled. They have access to food. They control 70% of Bosnia, and most of the territory they control is agricultural. Most of the Serb population in Bosnia were farmers before the war, so there's really no shortage of food on the Serb side in most areas. And this was Sunday afternoon, and they had a whole big spread out, fresh bread, roast lamb, brandy. They had sweets, Turkish sweets, I might add. That in itself was, I didn't actually eat that much. It was difficult for me because I knew at that moment, from having spent so much time in the Oslobođenje building, that what they were eating over there was this kind of thin bean soup and maybe a slice of bread. Knowing that, you know, it didn't exactly feel like having a big feast. I mean, I wasn't rude and I sat down with them and so forth, but, you know, it wasn't something I could enjoy.
When you were done reporting on the Serbs, were you able to walk across that 50 feet and go back to the Oslobođenje building, or did you have to take that same kind of circuitous path to get back again?
I had to go back out. Well, I arranged this so it was sort of at the end of the trip. I was on my way back to Berlin anyway. But no, I couldn't. It was, It was there was another. I used to carry mail in and out of Sarajevo for people who were trapped in the city, and because I did that, it was I really couldn't afford to cross a front line because I would be searched and my mail would be. The letters would be confiscated and so mm-hmm. forth. So I really tried not to cross front lines as much as possible. When you flew to Sarajevo with the UN, you could ride in a UN vehicle into the city without crossing a front line. And when you left, you could leave the same way. And on the other hand, when you traveled to the Serb-held portions of Sarajevo from the Belgrade side, you obviously didn't have to cross a Bosnian army front line. So this was I really tried to keep this to a minimum.
My guest is NPR reporter Tom Jelton. He's written a new book called Sarajevo Daily, A City and Its Newspaper Under Siege. Back in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing about the decision of former Vice President Dan Quayle not to seek the 1996 Republican presidential nomination and what his decision might mean for others who are in the GOP presidential race. Also on today's program, an appreciation of Senator J. William Fulbright, who died early this morning, former chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And we'll be hearing from the editor of a new dictionary of American Sign Language, which is on CD-ROM, on which you can actually see demonstrations of how signs are made.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is NPR reporter Tom Jelton. He's written a new book called Sarajevo Daily, A City and Its Newspaper Under Siege. You've covered the war in Bosnia, war in El Salvador. You covered the end of communism. Would you ever cover a war again, or is that part of your life over now?
Well, I hope it's over. It wasn't my idea to cover this war. You know, I'd covered a lot of stuff like this in Central America and really sort of was fed up with it. And then I got this chance to be a correspondent in Berlin, which is this great cosmopolitan city in Europe, you know, with great restaurants. I had a beautiful apartment. I was going to be covering, you know, the reunification of Germany and da-da-da, you know, it sounded great. I didn't realize that moving to Berlin, I was going to be setting myself up as a war correspondent again. So you never can tell. I certainly hope I don't have to. I think I've done my share of it, and I'm not anxious to do it again. So I'm just crossing my fingers I don't have to.
You describe how in Sarajevo people basically became fatalists, that you never really knew where a shell was going to explode, so there was a limit to how much control you could have anyways, but that there was somehow a difference between surrendering oneself to destiny and being reckless. Could you figure out a clear dividing line between what the difference was?
That's a really interesting distinction. Basically, to summarize it, people made decisions to not let their fear paralyze them and stop them from going about what they needed to do in order to feel that their lives were as full as they could be under the circumstances. So if work was important to them, they would go to work and they'd come home from work, even though it meant walking in the streets when they could be shot. But having made that decision and taken that calculated risk, the most rational and logical among them would make an equally logical and calculated decision not to push their luck. I mean, they would not spend one moment on the street longer than they had to. People learned in Sarajevo very, in my opinion, very intelligent behaviors. When I was there, I was just there, you know, in December, and there's basically no shelling going on now. But while I was there, there was one missile attack on the Bosnian presidency, and the missile hit the building as I was outside. I was walking down the street when it hit, and it was amazing to me that within 30 seconds, the streets were empty. I mean, people in Sarajevo have really learned how to survive and what to do and how to take care of themselves. And even though it's now been almost 3 years, they are not fatalists in the sense that they just you know, no longer take precautions. They do. They just don't allow their fear to stop them from living their lives.
You were last in Sarajevo in December. What was the paper like then? Or maybe you know what Oslo Bojenja looks like right now.
Well, in the last year, the situation has normalized to some extent in Sarajevo. There has been a ceasefire that's more or less held in Sarajevo for almost a year now. Bit by bit, utilities have been restored. So this great fear of not having diesel fuel to power their generators is no longer a big issue. Their day-to-day publication is not in jeopardy or questioned as it was at that time. The newspaper, I think, has actually improved. They've worked out more or less their relationship with the government. They have, as I said, established themselves as a voice of the opposition. Just this past week, for example, 5 members of the 7-member collective presidency put out a statement criticizing the development of Islamic influences in the Bosnian army, and Oslo Bojenja carried it, you know, gave prominence to their criticism and so forth. So I, at this point, feel that Oslo Bojenja has really established itself as an independent newspaper. It's a good newspaper. They have been able to get more newsprint. I think they are publishing generally 16 pages now. Fortunately, the obituaries are far fewer. They have gotten a wire service connection. The AFP, the French news agency, has donated a wire service to them, so they're able to carry a little kind of sports briefs from around the world. They had news of the World Cup last summer in Oslo Bojenja. They're beginning to look more and more like a newspaper. But as I say, the sense of morale just gets lower and lower. A lot of people from the newspaper, the best writers, have one by one left. They have gotten fellowships abroad and so forth. Not all of them have gone back. The thing is that nobody has given up. I mean, they still are plugging away, and yet, you know, in a sense, Sarajevo is going downhill, not because the spirit has diminished. It's just because the war just chips away a little more every day at their ability to carry on.
I'm trying to imagine what your life is like now. You've been a correspondent for years, a foreign correspondent for years, and many of those years were spent covering wars. Now you're based in Washington again. The book is finished. And I would guess it's time that you have to start, that this is a time when you have to start thinking of what kind of life you want at home. And I'm wondering if that's bringing with it a certain calm or a certain sense of crisis.
No, the thing about being a foreign correspondent, and for NPR in particular, is that you have to travel constantly. We don't have enough correspondents around the world that we can have sort of stable assignments. And when I was living in Berlin, 3.5 years I was in Berlin, I was on the road about 4 weeks out of 5. And that means you have a one-dimensional life, actually, just your work. And now I'm covering the State Department, and which means that I work Monday through Friday. I finish at about 6 in the evening, and 7 in the evening go home. I usually have my weekends off. And I'm really ready for that. That, you know, a lot work can't be everything in one's life, and it isn't everything in my life. And that's another reason why I'm not anxious to go back to this kind of foreign reporting. The wire services today are carrying stories that a general alert has sounded in Sarajevo again today, and explosions and machine gun fire are being heard again in the city center. So it seems like it's just more of the same. And there's not a whole lot more that I feel that I can do to report that war. I mean, I've written a book now that tells the story in as complete a way as I can. And I think my work in Sarajevo is close to being finished.
Well, Tom Jelton, thank you so much for talking with us about your work.
My pleasure, Terry.
Tom Jelton is the author of the new book, Sarajevo Daily, A City and Its Newspaper Under Siege. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio. If you wanna
do right. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from the co-writer of this song, Dan Penn, and the producer of the record, Jerry Wexler. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.